Let's get started, Ray, with
Yeah,
Putin's comment at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in Astana. And he was talking about the conflict in Ukraine. He doesn't consider Zelensky as the president of Ukraine. How did you find his statements?
well, I found them highly interesting, Nima. It's really interesting how Putin chooses after chooses to give interviews to Russian journalists right after major events abroad. He did so in Hanoi, and now, of course, he's done so in Astana. This was just yesterday. I learned decades ago that it's very important to pay attention to what Soviet leaders and Russian leaders say. And so I actually printed out a bunch of his comments, and I'd like to just highlight a couple of them, some of which you've already mentioned, because they speak volumes about what Russia intends at this point in time, and they should be taken seriously. Some of them are interesting from a domestic US political point of view. Here's one. Now, again, I don't know if these questions are canned, whether they're approved beforehand. I do know that the questions are provocative and they prompt Putin to say significant things. So I guess it doesn't really matter. He doesn't have to deal with frivolous questions from Reuters or from AP. So here it goes. The first one was, hey, how about Zelensky? Is he the president of Ukraine? And the answer was, well, no, we don't. The questioner says, we don't think so, do we? And Putin says, it's not that we don't think so. There's a constitution in Ukraine, and he's clearly not the president anymore. You got that? He goes, oh, okay, all right, okay. Now, next one. Who's better for us, Biden or Trump? Question. Now, you declared on that earlier. Have you changed your mind? Answer. What has changed? Nothing has changed, says Putin. The important thing to know is that the United States is still one of the major powers, the most potent military powers in the world. It's a member of the permanent member of the Security Council. And so we have to just take that into account at all times. What it does domestically, who it chooses to be the next president, that's domestic business. It's of interest, but we don't know what's going to happen, and so I won't comment further on that, says Pucci. Next question. Donald Trump says that he can solve the Ukrainian crisis in one day. There are reports that Trump may stop NATO's expansion to the east. How seriously do you take that, Mr. President Putin? I know that he's saying those things, but I'm not familiar with how he suggests going about doing that. How's he going to do this? And now, of course, that's the key question, says Putin. Quote, but I have no doubt that Trump says it sincerely, and I support it. Next question. Is it possible to have a ceasefire before real negotiations to get things started? Now, as you know, Nima, Orban from Hungary came down yesterday and suggested that to Zelensky specifically. Let's have a, how about a ceasefire in place? And Zelensky, no, we can't do that because we can't trust the Russians. Well, here's a mirror image of this. Putin says, no, we can't do that because we can't trust the Ukrainians. He said, when we had troops near Kiev, Putin, we received an offer and an insistent request from our Western partners to cease fire. And we did it. We were told that official Ukrainian authorities couldn't control their armed formations, so they kept kept on firing on us. Later, we were told to withdraw troops from Kyiv in order to create conditions for the final conclusion of a peace agreement. As you know, a peace agreement was under negotiation in March and early April of 2022. Now, remember, the invasion of Ukraine was the 24th of February, okay, 2022. So we're talking just weeks after the invasion. As a matter of fact, the head Ukrainian negotiator, a close confidant of Zelensky, best friend and head of his political faction in the Rada, his name is Arakhamiya, he was pointed to negotiate with the Russians on the 28th of February, 2022. So let's see, 28 minus 20, that was 4 days after. So it's important to keep in mind that the Russians from the very start said, look, let's talk about this, okay? And the Russians very clearly wanted to scare the hell out of the Ukrainians that Kyiv might fall. And that when they massed enough troops up there to maybe make a dent in that, then Kyiv said, well, okay, let's negotiate this thing. Arakhamiya was already at work in Belarus talking to his Russian counterparts. Then they went down to Istanbul. Arakhamiya was the chief negotiator there as well. Erdogan, the head of Turkey, was one of the facilitators, and he attests to all this. We can talk a little bit more about this, but it's left a very sour taste in Putin's mouth. And he says, you know, after what happened then, we can't just declare a ceasefire now and hope that the other side won't take advantage of it. That's what they did before. We need to ensure that the opposing sides do steps that are irreversible, okay, and acceptable to the Russian Federation. Therefore, a ceasefire is impossible without reaching an agreement beforehand. Now, it's interesting. I think that there's probably some flexibility there, just speculative on my part. Orban, who made that suggestion to the Ukrainians yesterday, is in Moscow today. Now, he's going to say, now I talked to Zelensky about that. Of course, publicly, he rejected it out of hand, but he sort of winked and said, well, you know, let's see if there's some flexibility in that. I don't know if that is so, but why else would Orban go to Moscow? I mean, he could easily report if he wanted to Putin over the telephone or whatever other secure manner. So that still is hanging in the balance in my view. But both the Ukrainians and the Russians have had bad experience with this. And again, that goes back to just 4, 5, 6 weeks after the invasion of Ukraine. And Putin keeps reminding people of that, as he did in explicit detail in his famous speech on the 4th of June, where he laid out chapter and verse as to exactly how that all went down. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, I hope. Now, here's another question. How about mediation? Couldn't you get some honest broker in there and do this thing? And Putin says, well, you know, it's not the broker we need. It's somebody with the power to force an agreement. And I mean, Erdogan was really helpful, but he didn't have any power to force an agreement. So mediation... It's always a good idea. We welcome mediation itself, but Erdogan couldn't do it. Who's to say who could do it? So that's the business about mediation. Next question. Oh, this one has to do with the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. Now, this is a main issue. Just to remind viewers, when George W. Bush came in 2001, he decided to leave the treaty that created stability, strategic stability, for 30 years. 1972, the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which briefly limited each side to one or two, actually first two, then one anti-ballistic missile system in each country. Why? What's the point of that? Neither side could ever hope to create a first strike without receiving a devastating strike in return. In other words, if you only had one defense thing, then you couldn't possibly think that you could get away with a first strike. So Bush got out of that in 2002. So that was 30 years. Now, another treaty, and this one was literally unbelievable, at least to me, with all my experience and all. When Gorbachev took Ronald Reagan aside and said in 1986, you know, we have all these intercontinental ballistic missiles, we have submarine missiles, we have bombers with missiles, with bombs, nuclear bombs. Why do we need these short range and medium range ballistic missiles, which give us warning time of half 30 minutes down to 10 minutes really in Europe. You have Pershing 2s going in there, intermediate range ballistic missiles. We already have SS-20s. They could easily devastate either side. Why do we need those for? We have deterrence already. And Reagan was advised in those days by George Shultz and Vice President Bush. I happen to know this personally. And they said, well, we'll give it a try. Now, I never thought that a whole class of short-range and intermediate-range ballistic missiles could ever be destroyed. I mean, they were in place. They were deployed. They had the warheads were ready for them. And they were destroyed. I mean, they were destroyed in place under mutual inspections. And my good friend Scott Ritter was one of the inspectors that went up to the god-awful place in Siberia to make sure that the Russians did destroy one of their missile sites. So what's the answer to that? The question is, well, that was possible with a minimum of trust. Reagan had enough trust in Gorbachev. And of course, the famous expression, dovere no provere, trust but verify. And Scott Ritter is very proud of the fact that he led one of the first teams in there to do the dovere no provere, the verification part of this. So now, how long did that last? Well, the treaty was concluded in 1987, okay? And it lasted until Trump decided, well, for whatever reason, our military said it would be good if we can develop intermediate nuclear weapons. And Trump, for whatever reason, said, oh, that's okay. That was 2019. So if my arithmetic is correct, that was 32 years. So both of these arrangements were canceled, first by Bush and then by Trump. And that's left a very sour taste, if I can put it that way, in the mouth of the Russians. So what Putin says here is, look, the U.S. got out of the INF treaty, and we said at the time that we would have to match their deployment, but we would hold a moratorium on deploying these kinds of missiles. Well, now we have them in production, okay? We've got the orders for them. And we're going to deploy them if we see more of this activity on the part of the U.S. side. Now, he cited two things. He cited that kind of missile given to Denmark, or at least allowed into Denmark for NATO exercises, and then one out in the Philippines. Okay, the Philippines, okay, intermediate range ballistic missiles. So Putin mentioned both of those And today we got news that the Philippines have made an announcement that that particular missile is going right back to the United States in a month or so. So it's not going to stay there. It's going right back to the United States. So that's a good sign. I don't know anything more about the Denmark thing. I'll have to look into that and compare notes with Scott Ritter and maybe Jacques Baud and others. So, but that's really interesting. What he's saying here is, look, we reserve the right to do this. We're ready to do it. We're already ready to start. But we also are ready to start negotiations, okay? Everything remains just as we said when that treaty was annulled by the United States. These are the missiles that were so dangerous during the 80s, and we destroyed them, and we can do it again. Now, we sometimes hear from the United States that they're ready to resume of conversations on these things. But then we say, no, they don't want to. And then we say, yeah, maybe they do. And Obama said, yeah, maybe you do, just right before he left. So we don't know how to read all this, says Putin. And he says, you know, it has an incredibly political character to all this stuff. And we understand that progress is, quote, impossible, end quote. Today, this is a quote, we must wait for the US elections and then understand the moods and the preferences of the future administration. We are ready for talks on this. We have always said we're ready, we will be ready then. So these things are nuggets in terms of how Putin is looking at things, including our election. He's not going to commit himself. It is interesting that he said that he takes seriously what Trump wants to do. He'd just like to know how he's going to do it. And that, of course, is the key. But he says, I'm convinced that Trump is sincere about that. So we have Putin saying that he prefers Biden. That was always a stretch. But the way he described that is, I look for one thing over all other things in a U.S. president, and that is predictability, okay? And on that score, Biden wins, okay? Wow. Well, that was, I think, 2-3 months ago. Now he's asked again, and he's a lot more favorable to Trump, saying, you know, if he's got a plan on Ukraine, let's hear it. Let's let him tell us how he's going to do all this in one day. So that's all I really wanted to say about this. You have to pay really, really close attention to what these people say. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to draw the implications from it. I would just close by saying that in the early Soviet Union period, when I cut my teeth on analysis, that was pretty much all we had was public statements. But there was a very rigorous discipline called media analysis, sort of a subdiscipline of political analysis, where you kept really close track of what they said from one day to another, from which you could learn all kinds of things that they were really thinking. That's not very much done anymore. And if you depend on the open media, of course, I haven't seen anything about Putin's remarks, his very significant remarks yesterday in Astana yet. Maybe they'll catch up next week, but you can't depend on that. So that's what I would say about watching Putin and his views on Ukraine, his views on Trump, and you know, his views on the intermediate forces agreement that was annulled by Trump. So, you know, it was Trump that did that. And Putin realizes that even if Trump wanted to have a more decent relationship with Russia, which I assume he does, he's hemmed in by all these false allegations that he's in Putin's pocket, that he'll give away the store. And he has to bow, as he did in 2019, to the military-industrial complex, who wanted to get out of the Intermediate-Range Ballistic Missile Treaty, the INF Treaty. So that's the background on that. Be happy to talk about anything else you have in mind, Nima.
Yeah. Ray, the other thing would be what Zelensky thinks right now. He just recently said that he's concerned about what's going on right now in the United Kingdom, the changes that are happening in the political arena of the United Kingdom. And recently we've learned that Le Pen in France, she's talking about she's not interested in sending French troops to Ukraine. How do you see the changes that are happening in Europe in terms of what's going on in Ukraine and how Europe sees Ukraine and the conflict there?
Well, I think you have several kinds of Europe. You have a new government in the UK, not quite clear whether they will be as belligerent as Liz Truss or Boris Johnson or that guy Richie Sunak. I mean, they may be, there's always a possibility they could be more sensible. But France is the big ticket item. My God, Le Pen. France is not going to be able to throw its weight around very much. They have real, real domestic problems. And even if Macron is able to finagle and, you know, sort of get people to play his game so that Le Pen is deprived of a majority, it's going to be really, really hard for him to do much. So you have, let's take 4 days from now, Washington, D.C., summit of leading NATO, all NATO leaders. You have Starmer, very, very new UK PM. You've got Macron, I guess, who's either a lame duck or a very badly wounded duck, right? Then you got Scholz, who's got real problems. His little coalition is falling apart, and with due cause, his economic problems are mounting. And then you have other people that are saying, well, let's say the head of Hungary. What's he going to say? So the question, of course, becomes pretty ridiculous. The main item has always been for the last couple of years, will they vote to accept Ukraine into NATO? Now, the Russians have been saying since 2008 and before, "Нет" means "нет". If you do that, there's real trouble. We tried to do that anyway, okay? All the way up to last year. Now, let's take last September. Last September, the head of NATO, Stoltenberg, he was speaking at a formal session with the EU Parliament, and he gave away the store. He said, look, the Russians don't want expansion of NATO, okay? They told us, if you let Ukraine in NATO, we're going to invade. We said, no, we ripped up that treaty. And what happened? They invaded Ukraine, but we got Sweden and Finland. So they got an expanded NATO. My God. What he's admitting to is that the Russians threatened in January of 2022, look, if you keep trying to get Ukraine into NATO, if you let Zelensky make these crazy statements like he's going to get nuclear weapons, if they want Crimea back, well, that's "нет" means "нет", we're going to invade. And Stoltenberg proudly says, on September 7th last year, we said no, and he invaded. Well, that's where it should stop here. And there's no consolation in Finland and Sweden becoming members of, at least not for any reasonable purpose. So that gave the game away. But more important, Nima, is that President Biden is making the case that Putin will not stop with Ukraine, okay? He will go on to Poland, the Baltic states, Hungary. Okay, he said this in the most recent debate. Let's see, I think I have some notes here on that. What Biden said, and I've written this up in Consortium News, was Putin, quote, wants all of Ukraine. Do you think he'll stop? What do you think happens to Poland and other places? End quote. Well, the real tragedy here is that that's repeated in our media as though it were the truth. What people don't know, because people don't read things that come out in the media as we intelligence analysts do, is, in a word, hey, Mr. President, Putin did stop. Okay, what do you mean we did stop? Yeah, he stopped when he scared the hell out of the Ukrainians into negotiating. I mentioned that he appointed Arkhamiya, the chief negotiator, on the 28th of February, 4 days after the invasion. Okay, what did Arkhamiya do? He went up to Belarus, started negotiating with the Russians, ended up in Istanbul, where Erdogan, the head of Turkey, helped facilitate these discussions, and the discussions were initialed. Now, do I have to say reportedly or presumably or apparently? No. Arkhamiya himself spilled the beans. Now, this was November of last year. He's talking to the Kyiv Post, okay? That's not Reuters or AP. And this is what he said. Title was, Russia offered to end war in 2022 if Ukraine scrapped NATO ambitions. Zelensky party chief is Arkhamiya, okay? Here's what he said about the negotiations. Neutrality was the biggest thing for them, the Russians, and they were ready to end the war if we took, as Finland once did, neutrality and made commitments that we would not join NATO. This was the key point. Still quoting, while negotiations continued in Istanbul, former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson unexpectedly arrived in Kyiv on April 9 and said that the Ukraine shouldn't sign anything. Shouldn't sign anything with them, the Russians at all, and quote, let's just fight, end quote, says Arkhamiya, okay? Now, that was refreshing candor by the chief negotiator for Ukraine. But those who were paying attention knew this a year and a half before, because Ukrainska Pravda had it on its front page. Johnson arrived, put the kibosh on the deal. So why this should be a surprise to anyone is beyond me, but it is. So I've got quite some reaction to all this. Putin himself, in that major speech on the 14th of June, talked about surprisingly, as a result of agreements that satisfied Moscow and Kyiv were indeed reached and initialed at Istanbul. You may recall, Nima, that a year ago, before a group of African leaders, Putin waived the agreement and said, look, here it is, thick agreement. They had codicils in it, how many troops, how many tanks would be allowed on each side. It was all painfully worked out, okay? So here's Putin saying on the 14th of June, the document was titled, get this, Agreement on Permanent Neutrality and Security Guarantees for Ukraine. In other words, the Russians said, look, we know that you're afraid of us. we want to make sure you're afraid of us. Okay, that's where we can reach this agreement. Okay. And so we're going to arrange mutually, maybe five power. We'll make security guarantees short of NATO membership. Okay. And if you want to join the EU, we withdraw our objections to that. We'll have an immediate ceasefire. Crimea, another thorny question, we'll put off sine die. We'll put it up to, you know, the way in the future. Okay. So that's the deal. Okay. So what does Putin say? But the path to peace was rejected again. The former UK prime minister said directly during his visit to Kiev, no agreements. Russia must be defeated on the battlefield. Thus, they began to intensely pump Ukraine with weapons and started talking about the need to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. Now, you'll remember that almost 2 years ago, our defense secretary, Lloyd Austin, said, we are going to move heaven and earth to make sure that Russia suffers a strategic defeat in Ukraine, period, close quotes. I mean, they're not imagining this. So why are 400, 500 young Ukrainian men now dead? The answer speaks for itself. That could have been prevented if the US and the UK didn't send Boris Johnson in to tell Zelensky, look, don't sign anything. You shouldn't have gone this far with the initialing. Don't sign anything. We'll support you for as long as it takes. And more recently, it's become, well, for as long as we can. And then for a while, we'll give some more money. But as Jacques Baud has said on your program, the situation with Ukrainian forces on that very long line where the Russians are on the other side is really disastrous. It's come to the point where a very clever, in quotes, Ukrainian generals like Sirsky moved some of their best troops up to a Kharkov region, and they were going to have some sort of offensive there, probably before the NATO summit in 4 days. Now, that's not going to happen. The Russians were ready for them. Worse still, the areas from which they moved these good troops are very, very vulnerable now. And it's very clear that if Putin wanted to do a large arrow offensive, as we say, he could easily do it. I don't think he wants to do that. His tactics have been very successful so far, not least because they save Russian lives. Their Russian casualties have been much less than Ukrainian casualties, no matter what Kiev is claiming on that score. So here we have a situation with an uncertain presidency in the United States, a clear victory coming for Russia in Ukraine, Americans not yet able to believe that they were lied to when, whoa, it's exactly a year ago that Biden was advised to say he was in Helsinki. And he said, Putin has already lost this war in Ukraine. He had a strategic defeat. And his CIA director said the same thing. So that was a year ago. So Americans are going to have their minds twisted around, well, what happened in that? Well, we don't know what happened, but now we're losing. Now the Ukrainians are losing. So how are we going to cope with that? Now, I've said before that since the stakes are so high for Blinken and Sullivan and Nuland and all those people who are responsible for this, not to mention Biden, that they're going to have to come up with some extraordinary way to prevent a loss in Ukraine and a loss in the election. I don't know what that's going to be. But I fear, as I've said before, that just as when they ran out of 155 millimeter shells, they went to these little bomblets in these shells. Now what would they do next? Would they go to tactical nuclear weapons? I don't want to even think about that. But would I put it past these guys to save their own hides? Let's say that competitor candidate wins. What's going to happen to Sullivan and Blinken, maybe even Joe Biden as well as Hunter Biden, from a person who gives every indication of being very vindictive? And frankly, with the manufactured Russiagate that did him in terms of what he could do with respect to foreign policy, his vindictiveness is easily understood. So all I'm saying is this is a very volatile mix. There are no good solutions, especially because who knows whose fingers are on the nuclear codes right now? Would it be reassuring to say, oh, no, the president's got, only the president can, well, that's not reassuring anymore at all. So if I'm in Putin's shoes, as I try to put myself in, I say, my God, we have to keep our powder dry. And these admirals and generals that are breathing down my neck, they want me to make sure that we're prepared for anything. And that's why I think he's moving slowly so as not to give any ostentatious idea that this is a terrible victory for a terrible defeat for the U.S. and a terrible defeat for the Democrats in the next election. So getting back to just summarizing what I said about Arachamia, nobody knows about that. I've had some really interesting reaction to having written that paper. But when you compare it with other deceits, like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, okay. We saw through that and we warned the president before that happened in three memos, we veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. But who are we? I mean, hello. Everyone in the administration says Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. Condoleezza Rice says, we don't want the first indication of this to appear as a mushroom cloud, right? Okay. So who is to argue? The Iraqis said, no, we don't have any. We were saying, no, they don't have any. But we had no record of credibility. This is different, okay? This is different. Biden says Putin wants to take over the rest of Europe, or wants to take Poland and the Baltic states, Hungary, okay? Now, the evidence is very clear that that's incorrect, okay? It's incorrect because Putin already showed that he's willing to take just a slice of Ukraine or even negotiate away a slice of Ukraine. In those days, there was not really any ambition to take a whole lot of Ukraine. The Donbas were two provinces. Now the Russians have taken four, so it's a little different. But what I'm saying here is that if you look at Biden's claim and you put it in the weapons of mass destruction context, whereas in 2002, 2003, we didn't have any really good evidence. Some of us did, but it was not out in the open. Now, this business here, where Arachamia, the chief negotiator, is saying, no, they did stop. We initialed a treaty, and Boris Johnson came in and said, no, we can't do that. And there the war proceeded. Well, those are facts, okay? Not facts that McGovern said or veteran intelligence professionals for sanity or anybody else. They come from the Ukrainians. And of course, Arachamia is no outlier. He's chief of Zelensky's party faction in the Rada, in the Ukrainian parliament. So I'm just hoping that people will wise up and maybe even the mainstream media will be able to come to its senses and say, it doesn't make any sense to pursue this war. particularly when we have a president that, well, is questionable whether he'll even run. So I'll end it at that.
Before wrapping up this session, I want to talk about the situation right now between Hezbollah and Israel. We've learned that Israel was hit by more than 200 rockets and 20 drones from the southern part of Lebanon. And in response to what Israel did in killing a senior commander of Hezbollah. And how do you see the situation? Is the situation getting out of hand, or it's still under the control of the United States?
I don't think it's under the control of the United States. So far, it's under the control of Netanyahu. Now, he's got a lot of things working against him. Olmert, a former prime minister, has accused him of every crime in the book, saying, "You've got us into this, you ought to resign." The military are not pleased with Netanyahu. The military is pretty much independent. Netanyahu has influence, of course. So the only people staying with him are those stern rightists who are wreaking havoc in the West Bank as well as in Gaza, and for some strange reason want to go against Hezbollah in the north. They're in Lebanon. Now, how strange is that reason? I don't think it's very strange at all. Netanyahu is pretty desperate. He cannot survive without U.S. overt, open involvement militarily. Now, if the Israelis go against Hezbollah, there's precedent for Hezbollah winning, okay? That was in 2006, for God's sake. Well, why is that? That's a long time ago. Now, they have all manner of very, very precise and very formidable rockets and missiles. 200 in response to the killing of one Hamas leader? That's pretty impressive. You would think that if they only had a limited number of missiles, they probably maybe 5 or 10 would do, huh? Right? I think that you're trying to show, look, this is what we can do if you dare to come our way. So strange? No, I don't think strange. I think that Netanyahu is crazy like a fox, let's say. He sees that he can't get out of his dilemma unless he gets the U.S. in foursquare. He's coming to Washington, my God. He's bringing a person who's under international criminal court indictment, almost, for war crimes. His defense minister, what's in Galan, okay? This is really weird. I mean, it's crazy. So he's bringing them. Now, how will Congress treat these people? Well, I think what Netanyahu is depending on is the power of the Israel lobby in Congress, the fact that the elections are coming up, and that he doesn't see that Biden has any other option other than to support Israel 105%, so to speak, okay? Well, now, is that crazy? Netanyahu doesn't have much alternative, in my view. And I think it may not be so crazy, because arms continue to flow to Israel. They're up to what, 38,000 Gazans dead now? Nobody's stepping in. But there is dissent in the United States. There are 12 very prominent U.S. officials who have resigned, saying that is undeniable, their word, that the U.S. has had a direct hand in the genocide in Gaza. So it's a very sticky situation. The worst, of course, would be, let's just hypothesize that the U.S. is smart enough to stay out of open military involvement against Hezbollah. Okay. What happens then? Israel has nuclear weapons. Does anybody think that they would not be attempting to use them in dire straits, in extremis? Who controls them? I don't know that. I don't know. If Netanyahu gave an order to the Israeli military to use a nuclear weapon, would they necessarily obey it? I'll have to ask specialists on Israel, but that's a big question, wouldn't you say? So the Samson option, so to speak, where they would use nuclear weapons, has come closer to reality, in my view. And I just don't know what's going to happen. It's very explosive. And why they're going against Hezbollah, the only reason I can discern is that they want the U.S. involved directly, militarily, bail them out, and face down Hezbollah and Iran. But I don't think Iran wants to get involved in an open battle with the United States. And I think there are enough sensible souls in Washington that don't want to get involved in an open fighting with Iran. So there are a lot of balls up in the air. Sorry I can't be more definitive, but those are my views on the implications of what's going on.